Argument, Bedrosian versus Northwestern University, Mr. Farkas.
Disturb that kind of a crowd.
Money.
The root of Wally.
May it please the court, I am Alan Farkas, appearing on behalf of Dr. Carlos Bedrosian. We appeal from Judge Grady's denial of Dr. Bedrosian's motion for preliminary injunctive relief. We are here because Judge Grady required Dr. Bedrosian to prove irreparable harm contrary to the congressional intent expressed in USERRA. Should you disagree with this analysis of USERRA, you should reverse Judge Grady's order nonetheless, because he was blind to the possibility recognized by the Supreme Court that irreparable harm can be proved in some employment cases. Judge Grady ran afoul of USERRA by demanding proof of irreparable harm. The congressional intent...
I don't understand that. Why wouldn't you always want proof of irreparable harm? I don't get that.
Your Honor, I...
Because it was an injunction, obviously imposes cost, especially an injunction that requires rehiring a disgruntled worker. That, you know, obviously imposes cost. So don't you want to show offsetting benefits? If the employee has a perfectly adequate remedy at law, why don't you just make them wait?
I understand the concern that the court has with that. I believe that is something we must defer to Congress on.
And well, Congress hasn't spoken of that, obviously.
We respectfully...
Well, look, all these statutes say the same thing. They grant equitable powers to the court. They don't say no irreparable harm.
The statutes...
And you've never given a reason why, you know, say if the remedy of law is adequate, then why on earth does the person need an injunction? And why would Congress insist that there be an injunction in such a case, no matter how, you know, burdensome to the defendant?
The reason, Your Honor, is that it is not possible to achieve the purposes of USERRA, and
of course
at the same
it is.
Time,
if the person has an adequate remedy at law, then, you know, his rights are completely protected.
Well, the standards that have been set and had been set prior to the enactment of USERRA impose a tremendous burden upon plaintiffs who come into the court seeking...
Now, how is this different from Title VII, right? Title VII, you have to show irreparable harm. Why should this be any different?
This is different because of the structure and the intent reflected in the Act. In terms of the structure in USERRA, there are absolutely no other statutes that I'm aware of that on their face show no statute of limitations, no costs can be charged to plaintiffs.
There are loads of statutes that don't have statutes of limitations.
I didn't mean to address that point in isolation, Your Honor. What I'm talking about is these cumulative factors, not only no statute of limitations, but also that costs cannot be charged to USERRA plaintiffs on the face of the statute. That is unique. USERRA provides
direct
access.
If there are other benefits, why do you keep piling on? I don't understand.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You could easily be argued the opposite, that given these other breaks that plaintiffs are given, they don't also need to be relieved from having to show irreparable harm.
I appreciate that. The difference, however, between USERRA and Title VII or the other employment acts is the purpose of the other employment statutes is to put these other disadvantaged groups on an equal playing field. The purpose of USERRA is to put USERRA plaintiffs above other employees and give them a privileged status.
Is your damage claim proceeding below?
The damage claim is proceeding, although admittedly at a slow pace. We will move forward on the merits, and we expect to prevail. However, at the end of the case, if Dr. Bedrosian has suffered a loss of his position and is only entitled to monetary relief, then that will be solely... That will be sorely inadequate.
Well, that's standard. A different issue. That's saying if you have to prove irreparable harm, you have. That's completely different from what I think is really not a very appealing argument that he doesn't have to show any irreparable harm.
Well, we do make the other argument as well, and that is that below, Judge Grady did not apply the proper standard of law in analyzing the proof of irreparable harm that was demonstrated. And we do believe that proof was made, and Judge Grady's order reflects that he looked at Sampson and Roth as providing absolute rules against injunctions in employment cases. Judge Grady's order reflects that he did not appreciate that Sampson left the door open for exceptional circumstances. The Roth case, which is completely inapplicable, was cited as providing some rule that reputation and loss of skills can never establish irreparable harm. Roth was somebody who was at the start of a career.
I don't understand. What's his irreparable? What's he doing now?
Currently, all that Dr. Bedrosian has that is in any semblance related to what he once had is he has a privilege at a hospital that is an unpaid position. In terms of his military status, he basically has a gopher position. He's an IMA, which means that he has the ability to come and serve occasional needs, but he's lost his right to do research. No, he can't.
Well, I don't understand that. He's apparently very distinguished.
He was very distinguished. There's now a tremendous black mark against him. There's a black mark against him for being a whistleblower. There's a black mark against him because he went from being at the highest levels after spending 30 years building this distinguished career, he was knocked down, and that's something that other employers can't be asked to just ignore. They have to attribute some reason to that, and that's something that was addressed to the court below in the affidavit from Dr. Bedrosian and the affidavit from the expert, Dr. Multini. And
with regard to his military service, didn't he withdraw one of the claims that he had made initially?
What the initial brief argued to the court was part of his proof of irreparable harm was that he could not gain any admitting status at a hospital, and absent that, he could not have any military employment. And it was stated in absolute terms. The change was he was able to gain an admittance privilege, an unpaid consulting admittance privilege, and through that he's able to have some military privileges. But he still has no access to the lab where he does his work. He does not have patients. He does not have any part of the reputation that he once enjoyed that allowed him to build his career. So that argument was removed, but his position really hasn't changed. It's a difference perhaps in form, but not in substance at all.
He still serves on active duty occasionally? Is that
He is still a member of the reserves, but his position has changed dramatically. He has gone from holding the highest ranking position to being the low man on the totem pole. He no longer has access to the samples, to the lab.
Well, he wasn't reduced in rank, but you're saying his job description has changed now.
That is correct, Judge. When you look at the proof that was made below, first off, I think it's important to recognize that in the cases that have recognized these individual aspects of the harm that was demonstrated by Dr. Bedrosian below, none of them come anywhere close to demonstrating the dramatic, powerful damage that has been done to Dr. Bedrosian. These other cases merely address certain aspects of it, and in those cases where professors and teachers have had some harms, the courts have responded to that, and reputational injuries have been recognized. The courts have taken off where Sampson ended and recognized that certain career paths are not chosen merely for monetary gain. And that when you have individuals that are...
So has his income dropped?
He has no income.
So why do you say his... Why is this irreparable harm? It would be very easy to calculate his damages, right? You just subtract subtract zero from what his income was, and you multiply it by his expected career life. How old is he?
He will be 61 on May 1st, Your Honor. And that's part of the point. Like the case of
Muhammad
Ali.
So what's the problem? He's lost his income, so he can sue for his lost income.
He would be absolutely right if that were his only loss. And the cases, starting with Samson, that say that irreparable harm is not demonstrated when somebody only loses a job that produces income, you are compensated at the end when that income is returned, particularly when you have statutes that provide for double or treble damages and attorney's fees and whatnot. But when you have a job that produces more than income, when we talk about the Chalk case, when we talk about...
What does it produce more than income?
He has spent 30 years, and this is demonstrated very clearly in the affidavit that was supplied below, developing a reputation. He travels around the world giving lectures. He writes articles. It is clearly somebody...
Well, he's still doing that, right?
He is not. He doesn't
Nobody
have...
Nobody invites him to give a lecture anymore?
As far as I know, Your Honor, those opportunities have evaporated, as was predicted in the affidavits that were filed below.
And journals won't publish his articles because his contract at Northwestern was terminated?
Again, all I can say is
that's pretty implausible, doesn't it?
It is perhaps a factor of the status that he had become accustomed to, and perhaps, I can only speculate, that there is some journal that is attractive on some levels where he could be published. But in terms of the work that he was doing, the authorship at the highest levels in the most competitive fields, he no longer meets that standard.
If he's still in the Air Force Reserve, he's receiving some pay then, right?
I would presume he is receiving some pay from the Air Force. I'm not aware of what that is, and certainly to go from a salary of $200,000 plus, that's a dramatic difference. But again, the cases have recognized across the board that when you've got loss of skills, when you've got loss of a professional reputation, when you have a stigma that will carry with you throughout your career and prevent you from having ongoing career advancement, and again, this is at the twilight of his career. He's not going to have a chance to go back to where he was. This is not simply a case where his monetary reward at the end of the case will satisfy. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Flakis. Mr. Galland?
May it please the Court, I'll be giving the argument this morning on behalf of all three defendants, the hospital, the university, and the foundation. And I want to go right to the question of whether Judge Grady abused his discretion by not finding that Dr. Bedrosian suffered irreparable harm. And the most important thing to point out is that everything that you heard from Mr. Farkas just now about what's happened to Dr. Bedrosian is not in the record, and there was no evidence of what had happened to Dr. Bedrosian before Judge Grady. Dr. Bedrosian was notified in August of 2002 that his contract a year thence would not be renewed. He was given a year to look for work. He waited until 5 days before the expiration date of that one-year notice period, and that's when he came into court telling Judge Grady that the world was coming to an end and that he would suffer irreparable harm unless he was given an injunction keeping him in the defendant's employ and service pending the lawsuit. And he predicted, he made a series of predictions when he did that. His first prediction was, I'll never get another job in academic medicine again, never. Now, you would think that Dr. Bedrosian, making that prediction to Judge Grady, would have come forward and said, here's what I've done to look for work in the last year, and here's the results. Here's whom I've applied to. Nobody will have me. But he didn't. There is no evidence that he offered Judge Grady about what he'd done in that entire year to look for work. None. All we have is lawyers' representations, and all we have today is lawyers' representations. If Dr. Bedrosian doesn't have a job today, we don't know why. We don't know whether he's looked for work. We don't know who he's looked for work for. We don't know if he's demanded $500,000 and nobody's willing to pay it to him. We don't know whether he's demanded tenure as a full professor and nobody will pay it to him. We don't know anything. So we start off with a prediction that we will never get another academic job in medicine, and we offer Judge Grady nothing in which he could say to himself, that sounds right, nothing. Then we have the next prediction that he offered Judge Grady. That was the prediction, and it was made as an imminent prediction. If you don't give me this preliminary injunction, Judge Grady, I'm going to lose my ability to serve my country. And it's going to happen right away. He made it explicitly clear. What's happened to that prediction? Dr. Bedrosian was clearly telling his attorneys a year thence that that was still the case because his excellent lawyer, who later withdrew, filed an opening brief in this court making the arguments based on that prediction. But then all of a sudden we got a motion to withdraw all of those arguments, a very honorable thing to do by his counsel, because it didn't come true. The prediction proved wrong. So the most explicit prediction of irreparable harm that was made by Dr. Bedrosian has now been explicitly withdrawn. And he didn't just withdraw a little part of that argument. He withdrew all arguments about military service or loss of the ability to do military service being irreparable harm, and this court granted his motion. Then he talked about he wouldn't be able to edit his journal. He's the editor-in-chief of a journal called Diagnostic Cytopathology. He said, I may well lose that job to Judge Grady. Well, Judge Grady didn't have to buy that prediction, and it's a good thing he didn't, because if you go to the website of Diagnostic Cytopathology today, which I've given you the website address for in our brief, you will find that the editor-in-chief is listed as one Carlos Bedrosian, M.D. Then he predicts to Judge Grady, this is the end of my academic reputation. It's ruined. Well, the first question is, why is it ruined? This was not a case in which Northwestern said, we're terminating your contract because you have committed cause. Let's go back to the argument that I heard at the beginning. This wasn't a cause termination. It was a contract which was going to expire as of a given date, and they decided not to renew it. And there is no evidence, Your Honors, that Northwestern said a thing to the outside world about this controversy. Anything that we know about any disputes between Northwestern and Dr. Bedrosian, any unhappiness that Northwestern has with Dr. Bedrosian, comes from Dr. Bedrosian's decision to file a public lawsuit and put all this stuff in the record. And that's fine. He has the right to do that. But I don't see how we can be accused of ruining his reputation from a decision that he made. And it's also implausible. For example, he says whistleblowers. Whistleblowers never get other jobs. Their reputation is always ruined. Well, this, if there ever was a case which shows that you can't make those sweeping statements, it's this one. Because what happened with the whistleblowing here was that Dr. Bedrosian, unbeknownst to anybody of the defendants, filed a quitam complaint under the False Claims Act. Those complaints, as you know, stay under seal while the government is given a chance to see whether it wants to intervene and try to collect the allegedly improperly spent money itself. The government took a look at this case and it said, no, we're not interested. Do it yourself. And he then dismissed his case rather than do it himself. The complaint was never unsealed, never served on Northwestern. This was, if there ever was a whistleblowing that was a tree falling in the forest with nobody there to hear it, it was this one. And the only reason that we know about the existence of this complaint, the only reason we ever found out about it, is that Dr. Bedrosian chose to reveal the fact that he'd filed and then dismissed that whistleblower complaint in his lawsuit in this case. So this is not a situation in which Judge Grady had any reason to expect any harm to Dr. Bedrosian's reputation. I would say, as a matter of fact, that it is not nice to have your employment terminated. We all know that. But there are many people in the world who would kill to be in the position that Dr. Bedrosian is in, having had his employment terminated. He has a resume 40 pages thick. He is the editor of a distinguished international journal. He is still a member of the Air Force Reserves, as far as we know. And if there ever was a person who was in an excellent position to go out and look for another job and get it and be snapped up if his qualifications justified it, it was Dr. Bedrosian. So this is not a poster child for irreparable harm. He is not. And Judge Grady was under absolutely no obligation to take these kinds of flimsy predictions and say, this forces me to find irreparable harm. What he had to work with was Sampson, and this court's cases construing Sampson. This court is a believer in Sampson, probably believes in it more than any other circuit, and has interpreted it in a tougher manner than any other circuit. And when Dr. Bedrosian comes along in his reply brief and cites cases like Chalk or other cases which have occasionally given academics a break, it would have been nice if Chalk had mentioned Sampson versus Murray. But it didn't, nor did any of the other cases that he cites, with the exception of one which was later vacated for mootness. And talking about irreparable harm for an employee and finding irreparable harm for an employee without mentioning Sampson versus Murray is sort of like talking about whether there's federal judicial review of the constitutionality of Congress's statutes without mentioning Marbury versus Madison. I don't understand how these cases could do such a thing. But every case which has discussed Sampson versus Murray in the employment context, in the academic context, has held this can't be irreparable harm. So the long and the short, to say no more, is that when Judge Grady was faced with these predictions of irreparable harm, he did not abuse his discretion by saying, I don't buy it. And there really is no serious argument that USERRA dispensed with irreparable harm. It would have had to act according to a very strict standard in the Weinberger versus Romero-Borsello case, and it didn't. And so for those reasons, we would respectfully ask the court to affirm this judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gallen. Mr. Farkas, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as counsel's remarks that there is no evidence in the record as to what has taken place after termination, that's necessarily so. That's the case of any employee who is suffering the threat of imminent termination. Had he brought his case earlier, the case would not have been ripe until it became clear that his termination was indeed going to go through, until he had exhausted his possibilities of resolving that situation. It was too premature. On the other end of the spectrum,
well, he could have applied for a job someplace else, couldn't he?
Certainly.
Did he?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I have to assume so, but there is no evidence in the record of that. I don't know why that was not presented below, but I can say on the other end of the spectrum, had he waited until after he was terminated, we would be in the same situation as the plaintiff in EEOC versus Janesville, where the court recognized that it could no longer grant a preliminary injunction with the purpose of preserving the status quo, because once he had lost employment, it was too late. He would come in, another employee would be displaced, and the preliminary injunction can no longer serve its purpose.
But how much time elapsed between when he was terminated and the preliminary injunction hearing?
I believe that time was approximately 9 months. And he
so
should have,
he
had
presented at the preliminary injunction hearing evidence of the search, job search he'd made during that 9 months?
All that I can say in hindsight is that would have been a good idea at this point.
Well, foresight, why wouldn't the judge be entitled to say, well, you had 9 months to look for a job and you haven't presented any evidence that you did, so you haven't shown irreparable harm?
That is certainly one factor that is proper to be taken into consideration. But the balance of the other evidence that was presented to Judge Grady certainly should not be ignored. And the balance of that evidence...
But as Mr. Gallen said, there's quite an air of implausibility hangs over the case, given Bedrosian's prominence.
Even if this court disagrees with the proof that was provided to Judge Grady below, Judge Grady nonetheless committed an abuse of discretion because he applied an erroneous view of the law. This is a special type of abuse of discretion where it's not just a question of how he applied the balance, but the measure that he used against that balance. And again, to apply Roth and to announce that as an absolute rule and to apply Sampson without taking into consideration the exceptional circumstances that Sampson allows for is certainly a mistake. Now, two other points that counsel raises. To say that Northwestern did not know about the whistleblower status or that this case had been brought is contradicted by the record. We should not assume
that's not what's relevant. What's relevant is whether the rest of the world knew he was a whistleblower and therefore wouldn't hire him.
Well, again, all I can say is that's something that was not specifically addressed below, but that is something that is a stigma that certainly can be attached to.
Well, it's not a stigma if nobody knows about it.
I would have to agree with that point. Nonetheless, on the balance, Your Honor, we do believe that the record demonstrates various errors by Judge Grady, including failure to recognize that USERRA does not require a proof of irreparable harm and applying the wrong legal standard to the proof of irreparable harm that was shown below. For those reasons, we ask to reverse.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Farkas and Mr. Galland. Next case for our